You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, October 8th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann. I'll begin with the Screenland section of the Times. The best parts of being a football fan are off the field. The NFL season began with dramatic injuries. Luckily for the league, we fans focus our energy on so many things besides the actual gameplay. It's a story by Jake Nevins. They say it takes 10 years to become a real New Yorker, but Aaron Rodgers seemed to earn his bona fides in just one summer. In March, after solemn contemplation at what he called a darkness retreat in Oregon, the 39-year-old announced with pomp befitting his superlative NFL resume his intentions to continue his career with the New York Jets, a young and hungry team whose otherwise first-rate roster happened to be missing a serviceable quarterback. The move took Rodgers from the league's smallest market, Green Bay, to its largest, and he leveled up accordingly, fashioning himself as a city boy. He purchased a $9.5 million home in the New Jersey suburbs, naturally, but treated a young teammate to dinner at Carbone in Greenwich Village. He sat courtside at Knicks games next to Jessica Alba and shopped downtown at Rag & Bone. He went to MetLife Stadium for Taylor Swift's Eras Tour and later visited the Gershwin Theater to see Wicked. And the Jets, newly hyped as Super Bowl contenders, were selected to be featured on the 18th season of the all-access series Hard Knocks, ensuring that HBO cameras would be on site to document the early days of his tenure in the Meadowlands. Indeed, to have watched Rodgers storm out of the tunnel on September 11th as the team's season opener, brandishing an American flag like the Marines at Iwo Jima, was to understand something of what was expected of him. But as is often the case in the NFL, fortunes changed abruptly. On just his fourth snap as a Jet, as Rodgers scrambled to avoid being sacked by the 240-pound Leonard Floyd, he ruptured his Achilles tendon. "I'm completely heartbroken and moving through all of the emotions," he wrote on Instagram the day he underwent, which was most likely a season-ending surgery. "I'm not a Jet fan myself, but I happen to be watching with several of them, friends for whom Rodgers' arrival in New York promised nothing short of deliverance from the hapless quarterbacking of Zach Wilson and a lifetime's worth of general disillusionment. It's been 54 years since the team last won or even appeared in the Super Bowl. This, of course, is one of the principal joys of fandom, to play general manager, to mythologize the only human, to imagine your team is just a single player away from glory, even if that player is pushing 40 in a physically debilitating sport, treats a COVID infection with ivermectin, and sometimes alludes to the potentially curative benefits of ayahuasca and the sounds of dolphins making love." This is not to suggest that Rodgers' embrace of unconventional science or even his age rendered him particularly liable to injury, only that fandom, like hallucinogens, impels a sort of magical thinking, one in which the cruel and random nature of sport is bypassed in favor of more attractive notions of destiny and redemption. That the protagonist of Frederick Exley's 1968 book A Fan's Notes, a hard-drinking New York Giants diehard, spends his time in and out of mental hospitals is an amusing, if dark, metaphor for the experience of loving a team unconditionally. If I admitted how much time I spent looking at the Baltimore Ravens injury report, trying to determine the difference between a high and low ankle sprain, you might suggest I be institutionalized too. But for the fan, powerless to affect the outcome of the game itself, the difference is endowed with particular narrative urgency. And it's a narrative, as much as anywhere else, that the fan stakes his claim. For Jet fans, Rodgers' injury could be integrated smoothly, if begrudgingly, into their enduring sense of misfortune. Soon enough, they had moved on to entertain new and ever more fanciful possibilities for salvation. Perhaps the team's owner, Woody Johnson, would call up the retired 46-year-old Tom Brady and offer him a short-term lease to the kingdom. Maybe the Jets would reach out to the former Colts quarterback Andrew Luck, who hasn't taken an NFL snap in 5 years, or recruit the emergency services of Colin Kaepernick, who has been inactive even longer. So propulsive was the discourse machine, and so Pavlovian the fans' response to disappointment, that it was only a matter of time before Rodgers' setback had birthed a fresh search for a night in football pads. This is almost certainly how the league would prefer it. The NFL's most serious crisis, aside from the perceived corruption of its ownership class, is the brutal reality of its product, made clear by the dire actuarial tables of its players and the troublesome but utterly mundane experience of seeing them carted off the field. But when fans can channel their enthusiasm from a comfortable distance in round-the-clock punditry, online betting, or the managerial cosplay of fantasy football, our attention is pleasantly redirected from the field of play to the abstractions of the depth chart or the waiver wire. Over the course of a football fan's life, you learn how you are in fact conditioned to engage with the game so that its most disagreeable elements are made tolerable or even forgettable. It may be no coincidence that our understanding of the long-term effects of concussions has grown. So too have our modes of fandom, most of which focus everywhere but the game itself. One player's torn ACL, suggests the talking heads, is his rookie replacement's big break, a tale of opportunity rather than loss. Sometimes this diversion isn't conditioned but forced, as the league and its TV affiliates decide some part of the game isn't fit for public consumption at all. 1 week after Rodgers' injury, for instance, when the Cleveland Browns star running back Nick Chubb's knee went sideways on a routine draw play, ABC refused to air a replay. "Yeah, we're not going to show it," said the commentator Troy Aikman. "It's as bad as you can imagine." From the whimpers in the crowd at Acrisure Stadium, we could figure it out for ourselves. Or we could head to YouTube, where one of several clips of Chubb's injury now has over 2 million views. It's a central paradox of football that if you do get queasy and decide to look away, you might miss something that temporarily reaffirms your faith in the whole masochistic enterprise of fandom. From the panicked headlines the morning after Rodgers' injury, you might not have immediately discerned that the Jets actually won that game. Down 10 points to the Buffalo Bills, they staged a comeback, sending the game into overtime. By that point, the air had long gone out of the Brooklyn apartment where I watched with the Jets faithful. Two left 90 minutes earlier at halftime, and the others were slumped over in states of numb disbelief. Then, the little-known Xavier Gibson, a 22-year-old rookie receiver whom the team signed this summer after no one picked him in the NFL draft, took a punt back 65 yards for a walk-off touchdown. There would still be heroes, it turned out, just not the ones anyone expected. Still, by morning, ecstasy had turned back to agony. "I'm tuning it all out. Not a fan anymore," wrote one Jet supporter in our group chat, adding, somewhat impractically, that he no longer wanted to be sent any football-related texts for the remainder of the season. I could understand the impulse. But fandom tempts us always with fun plot lines and fresh promise. The following weekend, we gathered in front of the television yet again. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. I started playing my sax outdoors. Then the fans came. When your rehearsal space is the bank of the Hudson, the audience is a bit unconventional. It's a story by Harvey Dixon. It was year two of the pandemic, in the spring, that I hit on the idea of having my high school saxophone refurbished. My 48-year-old horn came back from the repair shop in Midtown Manhattan a week later. I put it together in my Upper West Side apartment, and for the love of God, it was loud. A couple of days later, I saw my downstairs neighbor in the lobby, and he asked, "Is that a sax I hear?" He professed to be okay with my rudimentary jazz stylings, but I was uncomfortable. My building is directly adjacent to Riverside Park. The day after that encounter, I walked 10 minutes down to the bank of the Hudson, found an arrangement of boulders where I could put my case, and started to improvise to some 1960s soul jazz playing through my headphones. I was loud, gloriously, triumphantly loud. Within minutes, bike riders and strolling couples stopped to listen. Some took photos. After that, I took my sax to the park almost every day. Over the next few weeks and on through this summer, paddleboarders, canoers, and motorboats on the river hove to the shore to listen for a few minutes. When the traffic on the nearby West Side Highway ground to a halt, I got a round of applause. I had at least two cameos on Instagram. I find it hard to practice inside now, even in my building, where the jazz pianist and composer Billy Strayhorn once lived. It's inhibiting. I miss the expansiveness of playing outside, and I found nature surprisingly attentive, despite the noise. Robins and sparrows, and only one word is possible here, flock to see me as if I'm St. Francis of C minor. Squirrels stand on their hind legs and fix me with hard stares like miniature critics. My most cherished fan, though, was Zippy, a goose with whom I had a prior relationship. My wife is known as the Goose Lady of Riverside Park, but that's a subject for another essay. One summer day, Zippy and his extended family were paddling south down the Hudson, but then circled back and flew up to the riverbank next to me. Zippy sat there quietly for the next 45 minutes until I packed up to head home. There's nothing more satisfying than entertaining a goose you're fond of. But of course, it's the interactions with people that mean the most. Little kids in matching t-shirts on day camp outings are delighted. They clap for the noisy man. The guy with the wild hair eating a sandwich on a nearby bench loved it too. "Do you know Hall and Oates?" he asked. "You should learn Maneater. You could make a lot of dough playing that. Hey, if you need some grub, that church on 99th is pretty good." I wasn't sure if I looked like I could use a square meal or just sounded like it. To be honest, I stink. This is not humble bragging. I'm just realistic about my abilities. I imagine that for many people, what I'm playing sounds jazzy. Common questions from passersby: "Are you professional? Do you play in a club somewhere?" But if I showed up at Smalls, the Greenwich Village jazz spot, for one of their jam sessions and someone said, "Let's do How High the Moon in D-flat," it wouldn't take more than a few measures for the drummer to toss one of his cymbals at me. It happened to Charlie Parker in Kansas City in the 30s, although he went on to great things. I'm okay with simple chord progressions, or better yet, just wailing to a Jimmy Smith recording. But I still can't throw in those diminished seventh licks or tritone substitutions at will. It's shocking, really, how little I have progressed since fourth grade. I don't care. When I play outdoors, perfection is neither possible nor expected. In 1960, Sonny Rollins, already one of the greatest tenor sax players ever, quit recording and appearing in public so he could concentrate on getting better. He was living on the Lower East Side. He tried to practice in a closet. I've been there. Still too loud. There was a pregnant neighbor. I felt really guilty, he said, according to a 2022 biography. So he walked over to the Williamsburg Bridge and played outside day and night until he returned 2 years later with an LP called The Bridge. I'm not Sonny Rollins, but I can hear progress. I can be pretty jumpy in public. It's New York. You pay attention. And a sax is not cheap. I was playing a few weeks ago at another spot I like, just off the main path that runs through the upper park. My sax case and music were on a stone wall. At some point, I noticed a man squatting a few feet behind me, fumbling through some kind of bag. I thought, here we go. He stood up and lurched over to me, his hand raised, and then he said, do you want me to put it there? Indicating my open case. He had a few coins in his hand. This guy wasn't in good shape, maybe under the influence of something, maybe just struggling with life, but he wanted to share what he had. I said, that's really nice of you, but I'm just practicing. Keep that for yourself. You sure? Yeah, I'm sure. I did two taps on my heart. I love what you're doing, he said, quite emotionally. He gave me a soul shake and then brought me in for a bro hug. I love you, man. I love you too, man, I said. Really? What I should do is go to the park with a case full of dollar bills and pass them out to people and geese who stop to listen because I owe them for a music lesson I didn't know I needed. Harvey Dixon has been a staff editor at the Times since 1997 for the last 16 years at the magazine. He's also worked at the International Herald Tribune in Paris. Now I'll read a live review. U2 returns in Las Vegas limbo. In the inaugural show at Sphere, a $2.3 billion venue, a band unafraid of pomp and spectacle was sometimes out-pomped and out-spectacled. It's a story by John Karamanica. Perhaps the true gift of Las Vegas is how it renders the extraordinary as mundane. A place where this simulacrum of glamour available to everyone ensures no one gets the real thing. A city responsible for billions of dollars of commerce that has the texture of a Fisher-Price playset. A hub for some of the country's most beloved performers that blurs the lines between superstar DJs, cheeky magicians, and bona fide vocal heroes. But so there was Bono on Friday night, on stage, tantalizingly close, freakishly accessible, and in some moments, perhaps just a tad lost. His band, U2, was inaugurating Sphere, a hyper-stimulating new performance venue in which the whole exterior is a screen, and essentially the whole interior as well. Friday's concert was the first of a 25-show residency titled U2, UV Octong Baby Live at Sphere that runs through the end of the year. Throughout the 80s and 90s, no band played with the aesthetic of grandiosity more than U2, and no band made a philosophy of futurist communication so central to its visual presentation. So the choice of U2 to show off what Sphere was capable of made sense. A messianic band for a messianic venue. For 2 hours, the group, Bono, The Edge on guitar, Adam Clayton on bass, and Bram Van Den Burg filling in for Larry Mullen Jr. on drums, wrestled with a venue equally as obsessed with hugeness, pomp, and spectacle as U2 is. The setting was lavish, and the gestures were often colossal. And yet for all the vividness of the setting, there's still something not quite complete about this performance, which at times was winningly small, at others winningly huge, and then still others a futile ramble. For this show, U2 leaned heavily on its 1991 album Achtung Baby from the tail end of its commercial high point, an album that found the band, which excelled at earthen anthems, reaching for more ambitious and unexpected sounds. But playing it in full, though not in order, means peaks and valleys, meshed in vocal harmony on mysterious ways. Bono and the Edge sounded vibrant. Bono, who throughout the night performed his signature contortions that recall a person who just received an electric shock, was largely delivering his pleading howls with commitment, at least in the show's first half. Throughout, Clayton was dutiful and stoic, and Vandenberg brought a raw fervor that Mullen doesn't quite approach. But some of this era's indelible songs were, here, something less than that. Both the signature ballad, One, and the dreamily tragic, Who's Gonna Ride Your Wild Horses, felt tentative and less invested than usual. The same went for the curiously dry version of Desire that appeared later in the show, and a batch of Achtung Baby songs that appeared just after the show's midpoint, including So Cruel, Acrobat, and Love is Blindness, verged on grim and asphyxiating, rendering the huge room inert. There were a few lovely flourishes where U2 referred to other musicians, sprinkles of Purple Rain and Love Me Tender at the end of One, throaty nods to My Way, and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band late in the night. In truth, the performance peaked at the end with a majestic run, Where the Streets Have No Name, With or Without You, Beautiful Day. And it was here that the band used the venue to most potent effect. Suddenly the room was bright, as if a nightclub performance had been yanked out into nature. You could really see the audience, consisting largely of 40 and 50-somethings, including huge smatterings of loyalists in vintage U2 shirts and Vegas bros in tight Dan Flashes get-ups. It was a welcome and thoughtful recalibration of band to room and audience to band. Just before then, during the new song Atomic City, the entire screen was an uncannily clear street view of Las Vegas, with the buildings being slowly dismantled through the course of the song. A clever visual trick, gimmick. For some parts of the show, the band hardly used the sphere at all, only to display building high videos of themselves. Earlier in the set, U2 had used the screens just as aggressively, but to less potent effect, making it plain how daunting a blank slate of this size can be. At one point, a long rope, perhaps a nod to a magician's endless handkerchief, was strung from the floor up to the peak of the dome, where it intersected with a balloon illustration. A young woman came on stage to walk with Bono as he, and then she, held the bottom of the rope. For a time she sat in it like a swing, awkwardly and perhaps not terribly safely. It was confusing, distracting. When the screen was full, it was often cluttered with Barbara Kruger-esque phrases like The Fly, or with digitally crisp art that could have been cooked up on an AI generator like Midjourney. The illustrated endangered animals that appeared in the sky near the end of the show were an exception. Sometimes things delved into the realm of discomfort. During Even Better Than the Real Thing, the screen filled with Vegas iconography and characters from films based in the city, Elvis Presley, but also Don Cheadle and Nicolas Cage. The collage streamed downward as if it were falling behind the stage, which in turn made the stage appear as if it were tilting slightly upward, lending the whole affair the air of seasickness. Moments like these underscore that as much as U2 was playing a concert, it was providing a soundtrack for Sphere's technological wizardry and also its technological quirks. Four spotlights behind the stage were mobile. A drone whizzed around gnat-like, though it was unclear where the footage it was presumably filming was destined for. This isn't quite a conceptual spectacle like the Zoo TV tour, the original Octung Baby showcase. Sphere is the brainchild of James Dolan, a broadly reviled New York sports and real estate magnate who spent $2.3 billion bringing the space to life. It looks prescient, a glimpse of what even ordinary architecture might resemble a few decades hence. The entire outside surface is an LED screen, always on and always changing, though it repeats. Watching it from the windows of a landing airplane, say, or a taxi cab the night before the show, you might have seen it as a pumpkin, or a yellow emoji face, or a moist eye, or an ocean with creatures swimming through it. Impressively detailed and lightly shocking, Sphere registers in intensity, if not scale. At 366 feet, it's not even one of the 40 tallest buildings in Las Vegas. But on some level, its power is grounded simply in the novelty of the shape, even in a town that already has a pyramid and a palace and a castle. Dolan has already indicated plans to build similar structures in other cities. But inside it is simply a concert venue, albeit one with distinct advantages and challenges. In dry stretches, when the space between the band and the huge screen and the crowd was palpable, the result paralleled the airy emptiness of a corporate convention gig. In a stadium show, you can almost obscure a low enthusiasm performance. Here, there is no place to hide. That's because, despite the visual ambition the space demands, little of that burden falls on the band itself, which is largely confined to the size of stage one might find in any regional theater across the country, augmented by a Brian Eno-inspired turntable structure, though it wasn't used terribly effectively. It's a strangely vulnerable and inelegant setup for what is essentially a sinecure gig for a still-craved band. At the end of the night, Bono began cataloging his thanks. "I'll tell you who's one hard worker, Jim Dolan," Bono said. "You're one mad bastard." He also thanked Irving and Jeffrey Azoff, Michael Rapino, Guy Ozieri, Jimmy Iovine, and other executives. Earlier, he acknowledged some special guests, Paul McCartney, Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg. Also in the audience, though not acknowledged, Flavor Flav. It was a folksy way to spotlight the sheer extent of the labor, visible and invisible, that had just been performed. And it also highlighted the tension that remained, even at the end of the night, unresolved. Was this a big show or a small one? Was it selling intimacy or grandeur? Was it extraordinarily mundane or mundanely extraordinary? John Caramanica is a pop music critic for the Times and the host of the Popcast podcast. He also writes the men's critical shopper column for Styles. He previously worked for Vibe magazine and has written for The Village Voice, Spin, XXL, and more. Now I'll read the critic's notebook. Enough about Graham Parsons' death. It's time to celebrate his music. The country rock pioneer died 50 years ago at age 26, with two influential solo albums to his name, leaving a legion of what-ifs behind. This is a story by Lindsay Zoldez. More than almost any other musician, the country rock pioneer Graham Parsons' legacy is entwined with the story of his tragic death 50 years ago this month. The details are sad, macabre, and sordid enough to have inspired a movie titled Grand Theft Parsons. Let's dispense with them here and be done with it. Parsons, 26-year-old former member of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers, who dreamed of creating a utopian genre that he called cosmic American music, was preparing for the release of his second solo album when he made a trip to his adopted sanctuary of Joshua Tree National Park. On his second day there, Parsons, a prodigious drinker and drug user who once attempted to kick heroin cold turkey while locked in a room with an also detoxing Keith Richards, overdosed on morphine and couldn't be revived. His stepfather immediately arranged to have Parsons' body flown to Louisiana, perhaps so he would stand a better chance of inheriting a chunk of Graham's family fortune. But Parsons' friend, Phil Kaufman, intervened, remembering a drunken pact they'd made at a friend's recent funeral. "Whichever one of us goes first, we'll cremate the other's body in Joshua Tree Park." Kaufman knew a guy with a hearse, of course. The pair sweet-talked their way into stealing the coffin at the airport. Then, out in the desert, where the yuccas stretched their branches to the cosmos, they doused their friend's coffin in gasoline and set it ablaze. They were charged with grand theft larceny for the coffin. In the half-century since, this tale has been told and retold, embellished, and subsequently fact-checked. The True Crime Music Podcast, Disgraceland, dedicated an episode to it. Countless Parsons pilgrims, cynics call them grandpires, have made their own voyages to the Joshua Tree Inn and requested a stay in room 8, where their tarnished hero took his last breaths. On a 2021 episode of the Travel Channel show Ghost Adventures, the host and a social media celebrity stayed at the inn and attempted to communicate with Parsons' spirit using a device called a polterpod. Why has this cultural fixation on Parsons' death endured for 50 years, now almost double his time alive? Some of it has to do with the posthumous nature of his fame and influence. As his buddy Richards wrote in his autobiography, Life, Parsons, quote, changed the face of country music, and he wasn't around long enough to find out. Parsons' first biographer, Ben Fong Torres, put it another way in his 1991 book, Hickory Wind. Life, for him, was a series of incomplete sentences. For the last half century, then, it's been up to the survivors to finish them. In 1946, Parsons, then Ingram Connor, was born into orange juice royalty. His mother's side of the family, the Snively's of Winter Haven, Florida, had a booming fruit packing plant and at one point owned one-third of the state's citrus crop. Parsons was raised with his name engraved on the brass door knocker to his bedroom. Elvis changed his life. So did his father's suicide 2 days before Christmas, the year Graham was 12. After he was adopted by his mother's next husband, Bob Parsons, the musician's teen years were spent gusting in and out of schools, a North Florida prep academy, semester at Harvard, and even more disruptively, bands. Parsons was a social leapfrogger, unashamedly quick to move on, blissfully ignorant of the messes left in his wake. He quit one group he fronted, the psychedelic and country-influenced International Submarine Band, right before its only record was released. The Byrds had just fired David Crosby, and Parsons somehow convinced them that he would be a drama-free replacement, content to just hang in the background. Little did they know he was about to hijack the band, steer it in an unexpectedly traditional country direction, and help create a 1968 record that still has a rabid cult audience to this day, Sweetheart of the Rodeo. Roger McGuinn put it memorably and saltily. He turned out to be a monster in sheep's clothing, and he exploded out of that sheep's clothing. God, it's George Jones in a sequined suit. Parsons, ever in a hurry, was soon gone, but not before he released his first classic song, Hickory Wind, co-written with the Submarine Band's Bob Buchanan. No matter who's singing it, Parsons' late career duet partner Emmylou Harris, Gillian Welch, some random guy on YouTube. It's a stunner. But there's a particularly devastating power to Parsons' delivery. He sounds like a precocious child doing an impression of an adult, exaggerating the depths of his twangy baritone. There's an unshakable pathos to the performance, too. A pure but impossible yearning to return to a gone-too-soon Eden of childhood. I started out younger at most everything, Parsons sings at the beginning of the second verse, the most delivering the bulk of the devastation, a concession that there are still a few unspoken ways in which we start out old. In a time of cultural division, Parsons had a lofty and idealistic aim for his union of country and rock. He wanted, as Fong Torres wrote, to champion the idea of hippies playing country music for a rock and roll audience. When the Byrds were invited to play the Grand Ole Opry in March 1968, Parsons pulled a stunt that briefly united country fans and hippies because it made everyone mad at him. Instead of playing a rehearsed cover, he led the band into playing the as-yet-unreleased Hickory Wind. Looking back, I now view that night as a missed warning, Chris Hillman of the Byrds wrote in his recent autobiography. I should have known that night what I was in for, working with an impulsive guy like Parsons. And yet, even Hillman couldn't resist Parsons' pull. They started a new band together, the Flying Burrito Brothers, within the year. Hillman, for a moment, was a stabilizing collaborator. While sharing a house in Rosita, they wrote the original material that would appear on the group's brilliant debut album, The Gilded Palace of Sin. Somewhat shoddily recorded, but featuring some of Parsons' most impassioned singing. Parsons' best album, though, is also the one I find most difficult to listen to. His second solo effort, Grievous Angel, released posthumously in 1974, full of darkness, but also Harris's luminous backing vocals. Sometimes Grievous Angel just makes me angry, because his early death means we'll never know if he could have written 100 more songs as raggedly beautiful as A $1,000 Wedding, where he sounds flayed and old before his time, like a man in touch with oblivion. What if is a fool's question, but to be a Graham Parsons fan is to be constantly made a fool, because it's so tempting to ask, if he'd lived, would Grievous Angel have made him a star? Would he have created a long, rich discography, or would he have quickly become a pale imitation of himself? Would he still be around, or would he have found another opportunity to die young? To ask what if, though, is also a way to register dissatisfaction with, or wage a silent protest against, what is. Parsons was never shy in talking about music he disliked, and the watered-down, commercially palatable version of country rock, a term he hated, that was becoming popular in the 70s, made his skin crawl. He had an unprintable and hilarious way of describing the Eagles' music. There's an element of the poor little rich boy in Parsons' story, of course, but it's also true that plenty of his boomer rock contemporaries made snively level fortunes with decreasingly inspired takes on his own sound. On the flip side, as the former Eagle and Burrito brother Bernie Ledden once put it, how can you compete with a dead guy? You just can't. Parsons' hypothetical later albums are everything we want them to be because they exist solely in the imagination. Perhaps his death has become such a cultural obsession because it purified him, making an imperfect artist, an imperfect man, pristine. But there's still plenty of mystery and magic in what he left behind. Parsons was initially supposed to sing lead on more Sweetheart of the Rodeo songs, but his vocals were replaced with McGuinn's. Emmylou Harris once suggested they may have just been turned way down in the mix. If you listen real close in the headset, Harris said, you can hear him, because his phrasing is so different from Roger McGuinn's. It was like, she said, hearing a ghost. This is the kind of Graham Parsons ghost hunting I can get behind, close listening, straining for glimpses of him in the margins of bird songs or even in the backing vocals of the Stones' Exile on Main Street, where some swear you can hear him. Surveying the last half century of cosmic American music and seeing where the wind blew all those hickory seeds. I'll read, want to enjoy music more? Stop streaming it. Build a real music collection. Reintroduce intimacy to the songs you care about. This is an article by Denise Liu. The only music streaming account I've ever had lasted less than 72 hours in 2012. 2023, I'm still building a non-streaming music collection, shelling out hard cash for what the streaming industry has convinced consumers should be free. As a very online millennial, that makes me somewhat of an anomaly among my peers. I know it's a privilege for me to poo-poo streaming. After all, for those with less disposable income than I have, it offers access to enormous music libraries at little to no cost. But even for those who can afford to purchase music, the concept of paying for songs is a foreign one to many of us. People like me, who came of age in the decade after Apple introduced iTunes and before Spotify took over the market, belong to what is probably the last generation to remember what it was like to own a music collection that doesn't live in the cloud. Maybe that's why I never latched onto streaming services. I didn't like depending on a third-party platform or being part of a social experiment that feeds Spotify data that it then sells to advertisers. There's also the matter of fair pay. Streams are the slowest way for musicians to earn money at fractions of pennies per stream. Most important, though, I don't like how streaming feels, like I'm only borrowing something for a while rather than having a hand-picked library of albums, digital or physical, that I've vetted and can keep forever. I was still using iTunes until 2019 when Apple decided to sunset the app and replace it with a new media player called Music, not to be confused with Apple Music, the streaming service. The appeal of the app remains the same, a media player when I can see my entire music library hosted on my local machine rather than in the cloud. In fact, I have several libraries across different devices and drives that, much to my dismay, all differ from one another slightly. What I lack in portability, I make up for insecurity. Once I add something to my iTunes library, I have it forever. I have no fear of platforms removing artists or of artists removing themselves. When I started this journey in grade school, I, like many of my peers, got around the new order via dubious means. I started by importing CDs I found at the library, the Juno soundtrack, anyone? To my hard drive. I graduated to downloading MP3s online in the heyday of music blogs. Bit Orca by the band Dirty Projectors, darlings of the hype machine, and searching Google for compressed files. I was a DJ at my college's radio station where we shared files and browsed the station's racks for CDs we could rip, all to fatten up our iTunes libraries. These days, I'm paying for nearly all my music and have become more selective when adding to my collection. I lean into Bandcamp for MP3s. The platform's low barrier to entry allows nearly everyone to share and sell their music, whether they have a distributor or not, a limiting requirement for most major streaming platforms. Bandcamp is also possibly the best way to give the most money to small artists, aside from picking up a t-shirt from the merch table. If something isn't available on Bandcamp, I'll scope out used CDs to buy and rip. If I love something enough, I'll try to get the record. If it's out of print, I'll throw it on my wish list and cross my fingers for a reissue. At the end of the day, the goal is to have something to hold onto, a digital file, a CD, a record, anything other than an ephemeral stream. This isn't always convenient. Depriving myself of streaming means there's no easy way for me to repeatedly listen to a song without a deeper monetary commitment. But for me, listening to music is not about convenience so much as engagement. Resisting Spotify pushes me to actively find new music as opposed to sitting through Discover Weekly playlists generated by an algorithm. I tune into local college stations or online stations like the London-based NTS Radio Network and go down rabbit holes on YouTube, whose algorithm can still surprise me as long as I give it the right seeds. YouTube can be the most reliable platform for obscure finds like live sets or rips of small productions 7 inches long to time. I'm still trying to find out more about Naming Mary, a not-so-SEO-friendly 90s shoegaze band with little to no internet presence that surfaced after several recommended videos. This process of discovery has created a stash of albums that is dwarfed by Spotify's bloated world of curated playlists and anarchic algorithmic radio stations. I prefer that way. When everyone has access to everything, nothing is stamped with the personal memories, the particulars that hold our experience of music together. I don't need the entirety of recorded music at my fingertips. I just need the few curated albums that I cared enough about to collect. Having my own library means I can distinctly remember the context of every find, and that makes my intimacy with the songs I care about, the ones I can mentally fill in when one earbud falls out as I'm tying my shoes, feel especially rich. Denise Liu is a visual journalist at Bloomberg News. She's previously worked for the New York Times and the Washington Post. And now I'll read a letter to the ethicist, Kwame Anthony Appiah. My husband is facing dementia. Can I help him end his life? The magazine's ethicist columnist on how to assist a spouse in the midst of a life or death dilemma. I'm in my early 70s, and I'm married to a man in his 60s. My husband's father struggled with Alzheimer's for almost a dozen years before he died. It was incredibly hard on everyone involved. And now my husband is in the midst of his own health crisis. He has had some significant cognitive decline in the past 2 years, which affects his ability to function to his satisfaction. He's constantly looking for his phone or iPad. He gets lost while driving. He sometimes asks me to help him send a text or an email because he can't remember how to do it. This causes him so much shame. He says he no longer belongs in this world. His dysfunction reminds him of his father's decline, and he doesn't want to put himself or others through that pain. The neurologist is less than helpful. My husband does fairly well on 10-minute cognitive screenings, so he receives a diagnosis of mild cognitive decline instead of dementia. He's started to talk about suicide and is afraid I'll stop him. He's asked me to commit to letting him choose his time of death. Frankly, I respect his choice and believe he has the right to decide for himself. He's also asked for help in researching the best way to kill himself. I've considered trying to help him, but fear that I am committing or abetting a crime. What's the ethical thing to do? And yes, I understand that what's ethical and what's legal may differ. From the ethicist. So sorry about the situation you both find yourselves in and wish it were rare than it is. We are, I agree, entitled to decide that losing the cognitive functions necessary for a life of autonomy deprives us of the possibility of a dignified existence. And so we're entitled, in my view, to make plans to end our lives when that happens. Unfortunately, once it does happen, we may not be able to recognize our situation or to execute our plans. Even states that, unlike yours, have medical aid in dying statutes don't allow such aid to patients with an impaired capacity for decision making. It can't be secured by an advance directive. How do these broad principles and circumstances apply to your case? I'm not going to pronounce on the legality of helping your husband end his life, either now when he remains mentally competent or at some later point, as he fears he will no longer be. A lawyer can tell you how your legal exposure will be affected by the details of your assistance given the laws of your state. I will say that, inasmuch as it isn't morally wrong for your husband to end his own life, it isn't wrong for you to provide the advice that he requests. But to deny that an action is wrong isn't to say that it's necessarily wise or anyway that you should hastily pursue it. Right now, your husband, distraught, suffused with shame, anguished by the prospect of sharing his father's fate, could be prone to acting precipitously. Older men are far more likely to kill themselves than older women, and one reason may relate to gender norms. Men may feel especially humiliated when they come to depend more on others. The fact remains that countless people lead lives of value while experiencing some noticeable measure of cognitive decline. They're able to give and receive love, even joy, and it's possible to predict, and it's impossible to predict when deficits will cross into outright dementia. If this is what's in store, there can be extended periods of stability. Advanced care planning, prepared while your husband is legally competent, can give him at least some control over his medical future. In the meantime, I'd urge him to consider that his current impairment doesn't mean his existence offers nothing of value to him and to those who care about him. And now I'll read a letter to Judge John Hodgman on the texts his wife doesn't appreciate. When a reminder about picking up a package is about more than a simple chore. And Daniel writes, "When I walk the dog, I leave the house via the garage. Sometimes I see there's a package at our front door that we haven't noticed. I text my wife to notify her so that she can get it because I may forget by the time I'm back. She doesn't appreciate this, particularly when I do it even though I know she's not at home." And the judge writes, "I don't know what you said in your wedding vows, but I suspect it didn't include the phrase, 'I will love and honor you and treat you like my phone.' Asking your spouse to be a mnemonic device once or twice is no deadly sin, but cumulatively, it adds up to sloth, and I'm not surprised it inspires some wrath. She is a whole human being with stuff on her mind, too. Consider all the problems and chores that she's not habitually verbalizing to you, and just get the package when you see it." Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.